Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
So hello and welcome to the OnFit Podcast. I'm Emma McGarvey, Program Manager of the Sustainable Policy Institute. And today we will be discussing how we can design a financial system that responds to the climate threat and promotes a healthy planet. I'm joined by Margaret Kulow, who is Finance Practice Leader at the Worldwide Fund for Nature and who contributed to the April edition of the SPI Journal on this very topic. So welcome, Margaret, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much for hosting, Emma.
It's a pleasure to have you. So let's dive in. My first kind of question is, a big focus of SPI is how central banks are responding to climate-related financial risks. So could you talk me a little bit through how you see finance as a powerful tool for addressing the issues with climate change?
Okay. I'd like to start by going back a bit to the Paris Agreement, which was a historic global agreement that recognized we need to limit the warming of the climate to well below 2 degrees Celsius. Then came the what we call 1.5 degree report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in October of 2018. And that report clearly showed the expected impact of the difference between limiting warming to 2 degrees and limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. And I think it's helpful to see a couple of examples between those two because it's hard for us to envision what that, you know, what half a degree of Celsius looks like. So, for example, the difference between warming by 1.5 degrees Celsius and warming by 2 degrees Celsius means 25 million more undernourished people in the world by the end of the century. It means 150 million more cases of malaria, which already carries one of the world's hardest, heaviest disease burdens. At 1.5 degrees of warming, we could expect 9% of the world's population would be exposed to extreme heat waves every 20 years. At 2 degrees of warming, that goes up to more than a quarter of the planet's population exposed to extreme heat waves every 20 years. At 1.5 degrees of warming, we can expect to lose 70% of the world's coral reefs. And I think this issue in particular has gotten a lot of coverage. At 2 degrees of warming, they'll essentially be wiped out. The coral reefs may be interesting from a tourism perspective, and there is certainly some economic impact in that, but they're also the source of a quarter of marine biodiversity and food for hundreds of millions of people, including many of the world's poorest peoples. And we have a pretty strong taste now with what we've lost in terms of the tourism industry from COVID, what that kind of economic impact feels like. So again, those are some of the differences highlighted between warming to 2 degrees versus limiting warming to 1.5. I would note we're currently on a trajectory to warm to something north of 3 degrees. So the impacts that are coming, the physical impacts of climate change are really significant. And they're starting to hit policymakers and regulators are starting to take notice. So I think it's important to start with, you know, why we care about the issue and then what it means. Maybe if I turn to, you know, more specifically to your question of why is finance a lever or how is finance a lever for this change? So we have about $89 trillion in assets under management. Banks play a critical role in financing the real economy, especially SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises. And financial institutions are uniquely positioned to enable a transition to a more environmentally sustainable and resilient economy. They're increasingly exposed to climate risks, both transition risks and some of these physical risks that I've talked about, through their lending, insurance, and investment. And they're also key to financing the new economy, one that's circular and more resilient. So finance is not only a powerful tool for addressing climate change and nature loss for that matter, it's one of the biggest levers that we have to meet that target on time.
You touched a little bit on the Paris Agreement and the 1.5 to 2 degree benchmarks that we have there. And obviously one of the key points of the Paris Agreement is basically aligning financial flows with mitigating climate change. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how we can do that? How can we align financial flows with these targets? How can we align financial flows with reaching the 1.5 degrees, which clearly from what you said is essential?
I think there are three main ways the financial sector can align financial flows to the science-based target of the Paris Agreement. First, policy frameworks, things like clear and meaningful carbon pricing, reforming fossil fuel subsidies. And the IMF has written, the International Monetary Fund has written about, and the finance ministers for climate action have discussed both of these as recently as the World Bank IMF spring meetings earlier this month. So those sorts of discussions are already happening, policy frameworks. Second, voluntary action from financial institutions. Here I give one example. The Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance is an alliance where investors with roughly $5.5 trillion in assets under management have come together to commit to aligning their portfolios with this 1.5 degrees of warming, including by having emissions by 2030 and setting clear and public short-term targets as well. It includes engaging with their investee companies for decarbonization and also collaborating on policy advocacy for things like meaningful carbon pricing. So that voluntary actions for financial institutions is the second way. Third, regulatory requirements like climate-related financial disclosure rules that also can include clear guidance for scenario analysis. So by setting disclosure requirements or risk management rules and influencing financial markets through monetary policy operations, financial regulators and supervisors have a unique capacity to assess and mitigate risk to financial stability and thereby to redirect financial flows at scale in an organized and consistent manner. I'd say those three approaches, policy frameworks, voluntary actions from financial institutions, and regulatory requirements like disclosure can be complementary. And probably given the urgency of the action that we need to see, they should all be deployed.
From what you're seeing so far, do you think that these three frameworks are kind of are these challenges being met? So do you think that the policy frameworks are kind of that are being put in place are adequate? Do you think the action being taken by these organizations and in such kind of things as a Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance are meeting this? Do you think there is enough happening to enable that change?
I think the short answer to that question is no. And largely because the physical impacts are hitting hard. Policymakers will start to react a lot more quickly. One of the initial impetus for the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, for example, which came from the Financial Stability Board of the G20, was to make these risk, climate-related risks specifically more clear so that decision-making could follow those risks, so that investors could choose assets that were less risky from a carbon perspective, either because of transition impact, stranded asset risk, or because of exposure to physical risks, for example. Reputational risks, also a concern. That assumed that we could have a smooth transition to a decarbonized economy. The faster these physical impacts of climate arise, the faster or the more likely we will see policymaking that is not smooth. In fact, the Principles for Responsible Investment, UNPRI, has warned through their publication, The Inevitable Policy Response, that that's in fact what's going to happen. They estimated in their report about a year and a half ago that abrupt and decisive climate policy changes that come as a result of these physical impacts hitting more quickly and the realization of the public, frankly, that we need to act more quickly could wipe out 43% or $1.4 trillion off the value of the 100 highest emitting companies in the MSCI ACWI, so a leading global benchmark index. That means we need to act a lot more quickly. The second reason is a lot of or some of the climate modeling includes these non-linear impacts that are hard to foresee, and once you have hit them, it's too late to act on. So we really need to act in a more precautionary way, in a more proactive way, so that we don't realize after we've stepped off the cliff that we just stepped off the cliff.
Yeah, I think some really, really fantastic points there. So I just want to go back to the article that you contributed to the April edition, and you mentioned the need to direct financial flows towards nature positive investments and activities. Could you expand a little bit more on that and kind of what these nature positive investments will involve and what these activities could do and how that can help in terms of kind of redirecting these financial flows?
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll start with a little more background on what we see at WWF as the dual crises of climate change and nature loss. WWF's most recent biannual Living Planet report showed an overall average decline of 68% in population sizes of vertebrates over the last 50 years or so. Those are mammals, fish, amphibians, for example, about a two-thirds average loss of population sizes. That's a pretty good proxy for ecosystem health that's going in the wrong direction. Similarly, in 2019, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, that's the sister organization to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, to the Convention on Biological Diversity, so this similar global science panel, published their first global assessment in 2019, the first global assessment in 15 years. That report shared the alarming finding that there are roughly 1 million plant and animal species at risk of extinction, many in our lifetime. And this level of biodiversity loss risks undermining the progress on 80% of the sustainable development goal targets that they surveyed. So there's a clear linkage to our global development goals covering poverty and hunger, covering health, covering clean water, and cities, just to name a few. That striking loss of nature has something in common with climate change and indeed the rise of global pandemics too. They don't cause each other, but nature loss, the rise in pandemics, and climate change all share one significant driver, which is land use change. Land conversion for agriculture in particular has caused about 70% of terrestrial biodiversity loss and about half of freshwater biodiversity loss. And it also increases the probability of spillover of zoonotic diseases like COVID-19 and of course, significantly increases the appearance of zoonotic diseases like malaria, which we all know is a significant problem, especially in developing and emerging markets. This biodiversity loss and climate change are highly interconnected in a negative feedback loop. So increased temperatures and shifts in precipitation are key drivers of biodiversity loss. And we need healthy ecosystems to capture and store carbon. So a healthy ocean, a natural forest, nutrient-rich, healthy soil all absorb and store more carbon than their degraded forms. And degraded ecosystems also reduce the ability of nature to withstand shocks or to protect us against the physical impacts of climate change like storm surge. So the more the climate warms, the less we can count on nature to help cool the climate or help us withstand its impacts, and the less healthy nature we have, the more the climate warms. But what that means from a financial systems risk perspective is that if you consider nature and climate in isolation, you underestimate the climate risks, and you have an incomplete view of the systemic risk we face because biodiversity loss is also a financial risk per se. So financial institutions, for their part, need to start to understand what nature-related risks may be lurking within their own portfolios and also look beyond maybe the more traditional green investing in renewable energy to invest in and finance and ensure nature-based solutions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, some really interesting points. And I think one of the things that we are seeing is, in terms of kind of going back to the previous question and looking at kind of policy and regulation, and you touched upon kind of metrics and measurements, there's a lot more focus on the environment as opposed to biodiversity. Data which is being developed is looking more at kind of measuring environmental impact, doesn't necessarily look as much at biodiversity loss. And I think there is perhaps an argument that it is it's being sidelined a little bit for this focus on environmental risk. And I think this is something that WWF has examined as well. So why do you think there is less focus on biodiversity risk? Why do you think this is potentially being sidelined for this kind of environmental discussion?
Yeah, I think first I would say there has actually been a lot of research on the economics of biodiversity, including the recent seminal report, The Economics of Biodiversity, from Sir Partha Dasgupta in the UK. Some other examples of what has come out of that research. The OECD has estimated that ecosystem services like crop pollination, like water purification, flood protection, carbon sequestration, they globally are worth about somewhere between 125 and 140 trillion US dollars a year. That's more than 1.5 times the size of global GDP. The World Economic Forum has estimated that about $44 trillion of global GDP, or roughly half of global GDP, is highly or moderately dependent on nature. They've also found that the cost of nature loss is high. So between 1997 and 2011, for example, the world lost an estimated $10 to $30 trillion a year in ecosystem services due just to land cover change and land degradation. So clearly there's been a lot of economic research. Together with a natural capital project at the University of Minnesota and and Stanford, and the global trade analysis project at Purdue, we at WWF looked at the value of ecosystem services to GDP, and we found that at the current rate of nature decline, the world stands to see about $10 trillion wiped off the global economy over the next 30 years. So I think there's a lot of awareness of the economic risks, a lot of discussion of the economic impacts of nature loss, and clearly those risks can also translate to financial risks, which maybe gets a little bit more to your question, how can we look at this more? We've done some research on water risks, for example, which is, I think, the most developed area of additional risk analysis on the environment. We looked at, for example, water risks that lead to significant stranded assets, drowning and dying drying assets, if you will, in the power and agriculture sector in India, two sectors with the highest gross credit exposure in Indian banks. That research revealed that almost 40% of the gross credit exposure of Indian banks is in sectors with very high water risks. Combined with relatively high number of non-performing loans, we found this risk could place significant liquidity constraints on the balance sheets of Indian banks. We also similarly looked at the difference in credit quality of companies that follow more advanced practices in palm oil production, for example, than others, to help the Indonesian financial regulators understand the difference in credit quality and the difference in default rates among companies that don't follow strong palm oil standards versus companies that do. So we have, you know, to pull up from that specific example, those specific examples, we've worked with PricewaterhouseCoopers to develop a framework like the TCFD, the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, for nature, to help structure thinking about the financial risks and dependencies of nature. And that was laid out in a report called Nature is Too Big to Fail. We jointly launched it at Davos in January of 2020. In it, we called for something like a Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosure so that we could better enable the identification, measurement and disclosure of nature-related dependencies and impacts. We've been working with partners at UNDP, the UN Environment Program Finance Initiative and Global Canopy to help launch an informal working group with more than 70 financial institutions, corporates, data providers, rating agencies to develop the concept further. And we expect to launch this TNFD, Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, later this year.
Fantastic. That sounds like a really brilliant initiative. So maybe a big question, but then how do you think central banks, commercial banks and, you know, regulators, how do you think they can take this up? How do you think they can then implement the standards that you're currently forming to basically better measure biodiversity loss and to ensure that that kind of systemic risk does not take place?
Yeah, I think it starts from, and this goes back a little bit to your previous question too, this understanding of what biodiversity risk is. I think it's relatively common to misunderstand biodiversity risk as or biodiversity as the range of plant and animal species on Earth, and it's hard to envision how changes in those populations could become a material financial issue. But biodiversity isn't just this variety of flora and fauna, it's also the services that come from nature. So these services that I talked about, water filtration, oxygen generation, carbon dioxide capture, and pollination. Those services, for the most part, we have enjoyed for free, or at least with no monetary cost to us. As a result, we tend to take them for granted. We just assume the existence of these services in our business and economic models. So it's also equally complicated to understand the linkages between climate change and the loss of these sorts of services. But it's crucial to understand that you can't deal with them separately because of the way they work together and the way they impact each other. So we've been working to provide these sorts of tools, to provide awareness, I would say, in the first instance to financial institutions and also to financial supervisors and regulators of these linkages. We've been working together with experts in the Network for Greening the Financial System on how to increase the understanding of the relationship between nature loss and financial risk. And that group, the NGFS, will in fact be taking up some more work this year to better understand those linkages. And we've also been engaging with individual financial institutions to help them understand some of the existing tools like the water risk filter. For example, I think that, again, that area of risk analysis and risk awareness is by far the most developed in this space. And other tools like Encore, which was developed jointly by the Natural Capital Finance Alliance and the UN Environment World Conservation Monitoring Center, the WCMC. That tool was used, for example, by the Dutch Central Bank to look at what biodiversity loss means for the Dutch economy. So there are some tools available both for individual financial institutions and for regulators, and we're working with financial supervisors to increase awareness of these sorts of risks.
And I just want to go back to your point regarding the kind of the link to biodiversity loss and things such as the pandemic, and so many are seeing kind of this building resilient recovery from the COVID-19 as a decisive moment to make tangible progress on climate change and incorporate kind of biodiversity loss into this. What does a resilient recovery look like to you? What should kind of form a resilient recovery? How can a resilient recovery kind of incorporate some of the things that we've been talking about today, changing financial flows to kind of lower the temperature to 1.5 degrees, incorporating this biodiversity loss considerations as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. A resilient recovery is a recovery that recognizes the possibility of job-intensive investment in the things that bring us both economic and environmental benefit. So if we go back to some of the analysis that's done, the research that's been done by the World Economic Forum, investment in nature-based solutions that harness ecosystems to address some of our key societal challenges could create $10 trillion in annual business value to 2030 and create about 395 million jobs at a cost of about $2.7 trillion a year. That sounds like a lot, but for context, the COVID-19 GDP losses alone are already more than $5 trillion. Together with the International Labor Organization, we looked at nature-based jobs in a report last year, and we found about 1.2 billion jobs are in sectors that are linked to the sound management of natural systems like farming, fisheries, forestry, tourism. And nature-based solutions include many job-intensive activities like reforestation and watershed restoration, for example. According to the New Climate Economy Report, when compared to business as usual, climate smart growth could deliver at least $26 trillion in economic benefits to 2030, and more sustainable agriculture combined with forest protection could deliver more than $2 trillion a year. So restoring ecosystems, they found, could generate between $7 and $30 in economic benefits for every dollar invested. It's not a bad return on the investment. And in fact, the IMF in a recently released working paper came out just shortly before the World Bank IMF spring meetings. They pointed out that green spending, including things like zero emission power plants, protection of wildlife, protection of ecosystems, could return from 2 to 7 times as much economic impact when compared to non-eco-friendly spending. And these investments would leave nature, our economies, our societies more resilient. So I would say in short, we should be looking for a resilient recovery. And a resilient recovery is one that leaves us in a better place socially, environmentally, and economically for the next crisis.
I guess a big concern with transition and transitioning over to green is this kind of potential loss of jobs, is this kind of potential loss of, you know, economy. What are your thoughts on that? How can that be tackled? Do you think it is a valid concern? And you kind of touched upon this a little bit already, I think, but yeah, how can this kind of be tackled to ensure that kind of those skills and that labor force, you know, there isn't that kind of loss of jobs and loss of economy as we go from kind of brown to greener investments and greener jobs?
Yeah, that's exactly why we took up the research that we took up with the ILO, because from our perspective, you can't have an environmentally resilient recovery. You can't have an economically resilient recovery that isn't also job rich. So what we were looking for specifically was those opportunities where you can find really job intensive investments in things that also bring us a significant economic and environmental return. So from our perspective, you really can't, you certainly shouldn't, you really can't separate those.
Going back a little bit to some of the kind of data considerations that we touched upon a little bit today as well, and kind of how to measure environmental risk, and I guess going back to transition as well, kind of implementing these things that ensure that we are measuring environmental risk and making sure that the transition is just. What tools, data, and methods do you think institutions can use to measure risk and to kind of ensure that this transition happens in a just, good way that doesn't leave people kind of without jobs and stranded?
Yeah, some of the tools that are already available, and here I would say actually the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, the TCFD, has quite a set of available tools. And they've been building that out over the last couple of years. One of the ones that's featured is one of the WWF tools, Water Risk Filter, which we have used with a whole variety of financial institutions and corporates to help them understand the water risks that they're exposed to and also how to manage around it. So not just what you're exposed to, but how you take that information forward. As I mentioned, the Encore tool has been used by the Dutch Central Bank, and the French Central Bank has also conducted a biodiversity impact assessment on its portfolio. They used biodiversity impact score for the companies that they're invested in, reflecting commitments, so formal policy information and annual reports. They measure they calculated the impact of their activities on ecosystems and also measures to rehabilitate ecosystems, and they looked at actual outcomes where they could, like the percentage of rehabilitated soils, for example. WWF is also working on a methodology to help examine biodiversity-related risk at the portfolio level. So I would say there are some existing tools. There's also a lot of work in this space. The Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosure already has a website set up, and there is a toolkit in the website with a considerable amount of research and information that's already available. So while we're trying to get better at identifying standardized metrics, which we hear a lot of call for, both from corporates and financial institutions, in the meantime, there are existing ways to take a look at what you might be exposed to from a biodiversity impact and a biodiversity or nature dependency perspective.
Yeah, definitely. Could you talk a little bit more about what DWF is doing in terms of portfolio and managing a portfolio and biodiversity risk? That sounds very interesting.
That work has just begun, and we're trying to utilize the experience we've had in doing similar things with climate. We've done a lot of work with asset owners, with asset managers, with banks on how they align their portfolios to the well below 2-degree target of Paris, which is to 1.5 degrees. There are a variety of tools there. We're trying to take that experience and apply our science-based information to develop similar tools in biodiversity. One of the tools that we've recently put together is something called the Sustainable Financial Regulations and Central Bank Activities Framework, or SUSREG, which is easier than that long Sustainable Financial Regulation and Central Bank Activities. That framework was put together to support central banks, financial regulators, and supervisors, as well as relevant policymakers, to enhance financial sector stability and resilience to climate-related and other environmental risk, while at the same time enabling mobilization of capital for transition to a low-carbon, resilient, sustainable economy. So we've built on current best practices, ongoing developments in central banking and the supervisory landscape, like the work being done by the Network for Greening the Financial System. And we've also capitalized on our own experience working with financial sector stakeholders around the world. And this framework benefits from our perspective as a science-based organization. So the platform is live. It's available. And the tool will assess integration of climate, environmental, and social considerations into the supervisory activity and monetary policy operations. And we hope to publish the result of our first application of the tool in the coming months. Then the tool itself will be available to central banks and financial supervisors to strengthen their own regulatory and supervisory practices and enable their benchmarking against peers. So again, that platform is live now, and then the tool we will use and publish soon, our first application to central banks and supervisors.
Brilliant. It's really fantastic to hear about the work being done and the tools being developed to help tackle this. It's really, really fantastic. So my final question to you is, obviously going on from our discussion today, from your current assessments on the policies and the actions being undertaken, what revisions and changes in the current system do you think need to be made by central banks and policymakers and supervisors to build a resilient, nature-positive global economy in the future, and especially as we do overcome the COVID-19 crisis?
I would start by saying I imagine financial regulators don't like risks that they can't measure. But that doesn't mean that those risks aren't there. And we're already bearing the cost of some of those realized risks. And given the interrelated nature of climate and biodiversity, those risks are growing, they're growing fast, and they're nonlinear. That means there's a cost to inaction that also grows rapidly with time. So regulators need to recognize that climate change and nature loss are two sides of the same risk coin and use all the available data and tools to incorporate such concerns into their existing frameworks for financial supervision. They can require disclosure by financial institutions and their client corporates of dependencies and impacts on nature. As I mentioned, we have the current initiative under development to establish a task force on nature-related financial disclosures. I encourage regulators to engage in that discussion as well. Regulators also need to recognize the urgency of this issue. With almost a million species at risk of extinction, combined with a rapidly warming climate, that creates significant systemic risk that won't disappear, rather will accumulate and increase without any action. And they need to act through precautionary measures using existing tools in monetary policy and prudential supervision and regulation to mitigate ex ante those new physical risks and transition risks and support the financing of an orderly transition. So with nature, like climate, the longer it takes to take action to identify and reduce the risks and adapt our financial system, the more nonlinear disruptive adjustments we're likely to see.
Absolutely. So action definitely has to be taken soon. Well, look, thank you so much, Margaret, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. And thank you to our listeners. You can subscribe to this and all other OnFit podcasts on our channel on Spotify and iTunes. And thank you very much again.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFit podcast.